2. Johnny gazed with horror into the deep canyon. There was a flying drill platform down there, close to the river, and it was in real trouble. It was the day after their return from Yerevan. The storm had blown over, leaving a sparkling, white-coated day. But at these altitudes it was bitterly cold, and the canyon, as ever, was funneling winds into torrents of turbulence. Two Scots, one of them Dunnell Dean, the other a black-haired youth named Andrew, were down on that platform trying to recover the staircase, which had fallen 900 feet down into the frozen river. 60 feet long and built of rods, it had pierced the river ice, leaving an end on the bank. They had grappled the end with a hook, lowered from the flying drill platform, and had tried to fly the staircase up and out of the river. It was caught under water. Now sprays, coming up through the broken ice, were coating the platform with water that instantly froze, increasing the platform's weight by the moment. He knew what they were trying to do. They were trying to look busy for the benefit of the recon drone that would be there in a moment or two. The rest of the ship's crew were strung out along the chasm's edge, untangling the masses of cables and drums that had been scrambled by the storm. Dunnell Dean and Andrew had gone down there to look busy salvaging the staircase. Johnny had been returning in the small passenger plane to work out some new method of getting the gold. He didn't have a co-pilot. He had only old Dr. McDermott, the historian, who had begged a ride so that he could come up to the load and write the saga of the storm. The ancient Scot, who had considered himself expendable at the recruiting, was a very wise and valued dean of literature, but he was not in the slightest bit trained in their work, and frail beyond estimation, with hardly the muscle and skill one needed. There was no time at all to drop down and pick up a trained and agile Scot from the site on the cliff. They were using local radios. All the items of equipment had them built in, for their range and the range of mine intercoms was only a mile. The transmissions were also masked by the mountains to the east. The radio down there on the platform was evidently open.
"Throw off the real brakes, Andrew," Dunnell Dean was saying tensely. "The motors are overheating.
That will not disengage. 'Tis the spray.
Andrew, disengage the hooks to that staircase.
That will not budge, Dunnell Dean. And the thing is stuck under the ice."
The whine of the overloaded motors was also coming through the open mics. Johnny knew what was going to happen. They couldn't fly the platform free. They couldn't drop down into the rolling, freezing water. And that platform was going to go up in flames any moment. Such a platform had rudimentary flying controls, usually covered by a lead glass canopy. But the humans didn't use the canopies, and Dunnell Dean was down there in the midst of flying spray that was coating not only himself, but also the controls, with instant ice. The recon drone would be by in another second or two. It must see efforts to mine, not disaster. Johnny could hear its nearing rumble outside his open side port. Its hypersonic explosion would occur any moment now. The instant it went by, he would have to somehow get those two off that platform.
"Dr. Mack," shouted Johnny into the rear of the plane, "get ready. You're about to be a hero."
"Oh, my goodness,"
said Dr. McDermott.
"Open the side door and throw out two lifelines," shouted Johnny. "Make sure our ends are secure to this ship."
The old man scrambled about, grabbing at unfamiliar coils and tangles of cables in the rear.
"Hold on!" shouted Johnny.
He sent the passenger craft plummeting 1,000 feet into the racketing, wind-blasting roar of the chasm. The walls flashed by. Dr. McDermott's stomach stayed 1,000 feet up. The nearby white and red blur of canyon walls streaked past the open door, and he stared at it open-mouthed, barely able to hold on. Johnny cracked open the plane's radio.
"Dunnell Dean," he yelled into the mic, "stand by to abandon that thing."
There was the crack of the sonic boom. The recon drone had passed. Dunnell Dean's fur-hooded face was looking up, and Johnny realized it was not for the passenger plane, but for the benefit of the drone, so Turl would suppose it was Johnny there. Smoke was coming from the platform motor housings, blue smoke, different from the geysers of spray. The ice-pressured river was taking full advantage of the hole just made to geyser its way to freedom. Andrew was pounding on the encrusted winch with a sledge. Then he dropped the sledge and seized a bottle of burning gas and tried to open its controls in order to burn the cable in two. The bottle was thick with ice and it would not open. The passenger plane came down to 25 feet from the top of the platform, Johnny madly punching control buttons to hold it there. Smoke from the burning motors of the platform swirled chokingly into the plane above.
"Dr. Mack," shouted Johnny, "throw out those lifelines."
The old man fumbled with the coils. He could not tell one cable from another. Then he found an end. He pitched it out the door. Scrambling, he let about 50 feet on coil and then fastened the cable to a clamp in the plane as best he could. Johnny maneuvered the cable end over the spray-battered platform.
"I cannot find another cable end," wailed Dr. McDermott.
Johnny shouted into the mic,
"Grab that rope!"
"You, Andrew!"
shouted Donald Dean. 20 feet of cable from the plane coiled down on the platform and was promptly covered with spray that instantly turned to ice. Andrew took a turn of cable around his arm.
"Don't put it around your arm!"
shouted Johnny. If Donald Dean were below him, the tightening of the rope would break or sever Andrew's arm.
"Put it around that sledgehammer!"
Tongues of flame were coming from the motor housing of the platform. Andrew managed to break the sledge loose from the ice. He took two turns of cable around the head of it.
"Grab hold!" yelled Johnny.
Andrew grabbed the slippery sledge handle with his mittened hands. Johnny jumped the passenger plane up 20 feet, pulling Andrew up and leaving the end of the cable dangling over Donald Dean.
"The captain abandoned ship,"
said Donald Dean, and grabbed the cable end. Johnny put the passenger plane up slowly. It would not do to whip-snap the two men off into the roiling river to be swept under the ice. Andrew was hanging to the sledge 20 feet below the passenger plane. Donald Dean was dangling 40 feet below on the same rope.
"I think this clamp is slipping,"
wailed Dr. McDermott in the back. The iced mittens of the men below were certainly slipping. It was impossible to raise them 1,000 feet to the top of the gorge. Johnny looked wildly at the river. The flying platform below exploded in a violence of orange flame. The passenger plane bucked in the concussion. Johnny looked down at the men. The flames had hit Donald Dean. His leggings were on fire. Johnny swept the plane downriver. With frantically racing fingers, he brought it to 45 feet above the snow-coated ice of the stream. Was that ice thick enough? He dipped the plane. Donald Dean struck the deep snow. Johnny dragged him 100 feet through the drifts on the river to put the fire out. He saw a shelf beside the river, narrow and snow-covered. Bringing the plane within feet of the canyon wall, he lowered Donald Dean onto it and then dropped further. Andrew's gloves, which had been slipping down the sledge handle inch by inch, let go, and he fell the last 10 feet. He almost went off the ledge. Donald Dean grabbed him. Johnny, battling the wind, turned the plane around and brought the open door to the ledge. The two men scrambled in, helped by Dr. McDermott. Andrew reeled in the cable and got the side door shut. Johnny vaulted the plane 2,000 feet up and maneuvered to land at the pad on the top. Dr. McDermott was stammering with apologies to the two men.
"I could not find a second rope."
"Think nothing of it,"
said Donald Dean.
"I even got a sleigh ride out of it."
Dr. McDermott was clucking over his charred leggings, terribly relieved to find Donald Dean was just singed and not badly burned.
"I had my chance to be a hero,"
said Dr. McDermott,
"and I muffed it."
"You did just fine," said Andrew. "Just fine."
Johnny got out of the plane and walked over to the canyon edge. They followed him. The shift crew was also staring down, their faces shiny from the perspiration of strain. It had been a wild thing to watch. Shaking his head, Johnny looked down 1,000 feet to where the edge of the staircase was embedded in the bank. The flying platform had vanished under the ice. The snow around the place was pockmarked with the impacts of broken bits and blackened from the explosion. Johnny faced Donald Dean and the crew.
That, said Johnny, is that.
The shift boss and Donald Dean said, almost in chorus,
But we can't quit.
No more of these acrobatics in thin air, said Johnny. No more hanging over this edge with our hearts in our throats. Come with me. They followed him back to the pad. He pointed straight down. Below us, said Johnny, that vein is extending into the cliff. It's a pocket vein. Pockets of gold probably occur every few hundred feet. We're going to put a shaft down to that vein. Then we're going to drift along that vein underground to the cliff edge and try to recover that gold from behind. They were silent. But that fissure out there, we can't blast. It would knock the face of the cliff off. We're just going to have to use drills, point drills to go in with parallel holes, then vibrating spades to literally cut the rock. It will take time. We can work hard and maybe get there.
Underground?
It dawned on them it was a great idea. The shift boss and Donald Dean started making plans to fly in drilling machinery and scrapers and bucket conveyors. Waves of relief began to spread. The ship change crew flew in, and when they heard about it, they cheered. They had hated hanging by their heels in greedy space with little return to show. Get it set up and rolling before the next passover of the drone, said Johnny. Turl's gone crazy, but he's a miner. He'll see what we're doing and hold off. It's like taking rock out with teaspoons, so we'll work this all three shifts around the clock. It'll be easier to work underground in this weather anyway. We'll use the dig out to enlarge this flat space. Now, where's a transit so we can get the exact direction down and over for the dig? The sound of the plane revved up. Donald Dean was going back for pilots and equipment.
We might make it yet, thought Johnny.
3. A worried Zit was watching Turl and a swarm of mechanics working over the old bomber drone. The huge underground garages and hangars resounded with the whine of drills and clang of hammers. Since the last semi-annual personnel intake, Zit had gotten his mechanics back. Aside from exchanging recon drones for refueling every 3 days, a drone he considered useless, his work was not backlogged. Turl had left the transport chief and section alone until now. Turl himself had serviced the 20 battle planes in the outside field. So aside from this present unexpected project, Zit had little about which to complain. But this idiocy, the bomber drone? He knew he had better speak. Turl was in the huge plane's control room, working with presets of buttons. He was covered with grease and sweat. He had a small remote keyboard in his hand, and he was punching settings into the main panels of the ship.
Scotland, Sweden, Turl was saying, consulting his tables and notes and pushing ship buttons.
There were no seats in the place, for it would never be piloted, and Turl was hunched uncomfortably on a balance motor housing.
Russia, Alps, Italy, China, no, Alps. India, China, Italy, Africa.
Turl, said Zit timidly.
Shut up, snapped Turl, not even looking up. Amazon, Andes, Mexico, Rocky Mountains, 1, 2, and 3.